Chapter 31. The Cleansing.
"You may tell your master I delivered his message," I said.
Hildegrin smiled. "And have you a message to return, Armiger? Remember, I am from the Coruscant Penetralia."
"No," I said. "None."
Dorcas looked up.
"I do. A person I met in the gardens of the House Absolute told me I would encounter someone who identified himself thus, and that I was to say to him, 'When the leaves are grown, the wood is to march north.'"
Hildegrin laid a finger beside his nose. "All the wood? Is that what he said?"
"He gave me the words I have already recited to you and nothing more."
"Dorcas," I asked,
"why didn't you tell me this? I've hardly had an opportunity to talk to you alone since we met at the crossing of the paths. And besides, I could see it was a dangerous thing to know. I couldn't see any reason to put that danger on you. It was the man who gave Dr. Talos all that money who told me. But he didn't give Dr. Talos the message. I know because I listened when they talked. He only said that he was your friend and told me."
"And told you to tell me?"
Dorcas shook her head.
Hildegrin's thick-throated chuckle might almost have come from underground. "Well, it don't hardly matter now, does it? It's been delivered. And for myself, I don't mind telling you. I wouldn't have minded if it had waited a little longer. But we're all friends here. Except maybe for the sick girl. And I don't think she can hear what's said or understand what we're talking about if she could. What did you say her name was? I couldn't hear you too clear when I was over there on the other side."
"That was because I didn't say it at all," I told him. "But her name is Jolenta." As I pronounced Jolenta, I looked at her and, seeing her in the firelight, realized she was Jolenta no longer. Nothing of the beautiful woman Jonas had loved remained in that haggard face.
"And a bat bite did it? They've grown uncommon strong lately, then. I've been bit a couple of times myself."
I looked at Hildegrin sharply, and he added,
"Oh, yes, I've seen her before, young sir. As well as yourself and little Dorcas. You didn't think I let you and that other gal leave the Botanic Gardens alone, did you? Not with you talking of going north and fighting an officer of the Septentrians. I saw you fight, and saw you take that fellow's head off. I helped to catch him, by the by, because I thought he might be from the House Absolute for true, and I was in the back of the people that watched you on the stage that night. I didn't lose you till the affair at the gate the next day. I seen you, and I seen her, though there's not much left of her now except the hair. And I think even that's changed."
Merrin asked the Cumean, "Shall I tell them, Mother?"
The old woman nodded.
"If you can, child. She has been imbued with a glamour that rendered her beautiful. It is fading fast now, because of the blood she lost, and because she has had a great deal of exercise. By morning, only traces will remain."
Dorcas drew back.
"Magic, you mean? There is no magic. There is only knowledge, more or less hidden."
Hildegrin was staring at Jolenta with a thoughtful expression.
"I didn't know looks could be changed so much. That might be useful, that might. Can your mistress do it?"
"She could do much more than this if she willed it."
Dorcas whispered,
"But how was this done? There have been substances drawn from the glands of beasts added to her blood to change the pattern in which her flesh was deposited. Those gave her a slender waist, breasts like melons, and so on. They may have been used to add calf to her legs as well. Cleaning and the application of health-thinning broths to the skin freshened her face. Her teeth were cleaned too, and some were ground down and given false crowns. One has fallen away now, if you'll look. Her hair was dyed and thickened by sewing threads of colored silk into her scalp. No doubt much body hair was killed as well, and that at least will remain so. Most important, she was promised beauty while entranced. Such promises are believed with faith greater than any child's, and her belief compelled yours. Can nothing be done for her? Dorcas asked. Not by me, and it is not a task of the kind the Cumaean undertakes, save in great need. But she will live, as my mother told you, though she will not wish it.
Hildegrin cleared his throat and spat over the side of the roof. That's settled, then. We've done what we can for her, and it's all we can do. So what I say is, let's get on with what we come for. Like you said, Cumaean, it's good these others showed up. I got the message I was supposed to, and they're friends of the Liege of Leaves, just like me. The armiger here can help me fetch up this Apu Punchau. And what with my two fellows being killed on the road, I'll be glad to have them. So what's to keep us from going ahead?
Nothing, the Cumaean murmured. The star is in the ascendant. Dorcas said, if we're going to assist you with something, shouldn't we know what it is?
Bringing back the past, Hildegrin told her grandly. Diving back into the time of old Earth's greatness. There was somebody who used to live in this here place we're sitting on that knew things that could make a difference. I intend to have him up. It'll be the high point, if I may say it, of a career that's already considered pretty spectacular in known circles.
I asked, you're going to open the tomb? Surely even with Alzabo. The Cumaean reached out to smooth Jolenta's forehead. We may call it a tomb, but it was not his. His house, rather.
You see what with me working so near? Hildegrin explained. I've been in the way to do the Chatelaine a favor now and again. More than one, if I may say it, and more than two. Finally, I figured the time had come for me to collect. I mentioned my little plan to the Master of the Wood, you may be sure. And here we are.
I said, I had been given to understand that the Cumaean served Father Anir.
She pays her debts, Hildegrin announced smugly. Quality always does, and you don't have to be a wise woman to know it might be wise to have a few friends on the other side, just in case that's the side that wins.
Dorcas asked the Cumaean, who was this Apu Punchau, and why is his palace still standing when the rest of the town is only tumbled stones? When the old woman did not reply, Merrin said, less than a legend. For not even scholars now remember his story. The mother has told us that his name means the head of day. In the earliest eons, he appeared among the people here and taught them many wonderful secrets. Often he vanished, but always he returned. At last, he did not return, and invaders laid waste to his cities. Now he shall return for the last time. Indeed? Without magic? The Cumaean looked up at Dorcas with eyes that seemed as bright as the stars. Words are symbols. Merrin chooses to delimit magic as that which does not exist. And so it does not exist. If you choose to call what we are about to do here magic, then magic lives while we do it. In ancient days,
in a land far off, there stood two empires, divided by mountains. One dressed its soldiers in yellow, the other in green. For 100 generations they struggled. I see that the man with you knows the tale.
And after 100 generations, I said, an Eremite came among them and counseled the emperor of the yellow army to dress his men in green, and the master of the green army, that he should clothe it in yellow. But the battle continued as before. In my sabretash, I have a book called The Wonders of Earth and Sky, and the story is told there.
That is the wisest of all the books of men,
the Cumean said,
though there are few who can gain any benefit from reading it. Child, explain to this man, who will be a sage in time, what we do tonight.
The young witch nodded.
All time exists. That is the truth beyond the legends the Epops tell. If the future did not exist now, how could we journey toward it? If the past does not exist still, how could we leave it behind us? In sleep, the mind is encircled by its time, which is why we so often hear the voices of the dead there and receive intelligence of things to come. Those who, like the mother, have learned to enter the same state while waking live surrounded by their own lives, even as the Abraxas perceives all of time as an eternal instant.
There had been little wind that night, but I noticed now that such wind as there had been had died utterly. A stillness hung in the air, so that despite the softness of Dorcas's voice, her words seemed to ring.
Is that what this woman you call the Cumean will do then? Enter that state, and speaking with the voice of the dead, tell this man whatever it is he wishes to know?
She cannot. She is very old. But this city was devastated whole ages before she came to be. Only her own time rings her, for that is all her mind comprehends by direct knowledge. To restore the city, we must make use of a mind that existed when it was whole.
And is there anyone in the world that old?
The Cumean shook her head.
In the world, no. Yet such a mind exists. Look where I point, child, just above the clouds. The red star there is called the Fish's Mouth. And on its one surviving world, there dwells an ancient and acute mind. Merrin, take my hand, and you, Badger, take the other. Torturer, take the right hand of your sick friend and Hildegrin's. Your paramour must take the sick woman's other hand and Merrin's. Now we are linked, men to one side, women to the other.
And we'd best do something quick, Hildegrin grumbled. There's a storm coming, I would say.
We shall, as quickly as may be.
Now I must use all your minds, and the sick woman's will be of little help. You will feel me guiding your thought. Do as I bid you.
Releasing Merrin's hand for a moment, the old woman, if she were in truth a woman at all, reached into her bodice and drew out a rod whose tips vanished into the night as if they were at the borders of my field of vision, though it was hardly longer than a dagger. She opened her mouth. I thought she meant to hold the rod between her teeth, but she swallowed it. A moment later, I could detect its glowing image, muted and tinged with crimson, below the sagging skin of her throat.
Close eyes, all of you. There is a woman here I do not know, a high woman chained.
Never mind, torturer, I know her now.
Do not shrink from my hand. None of you shrink from my hand.
In the stupor that had followed Vodalus's banquet, I had known what it was to share my mind with another. This was different. The Cumean did not appear as I had seen her, or as
a young version of herself, or, as it seemed to me, as anything. Rather, I found my thoughts surrounded by hers, as a fish in a bowl floats in a bubble of invisible water. Thecla was there with me, but I could not see her whole. It was as if she were standing behind me, and I saw her hand over my shoulder at one moment and felt her breath on my cheek at the next. Then she was gone and everything with her. I felt my thought hurled off into the night, lost among the ruins. When I recovered, I was lying on the tiles near the fire. My mouth was wet with the foam of my spittle mixed with my own blood, for I had bitten my lips and tongue. My legs were too weak to stand, but I raised myself to a sitting posture again. At first I thought the others were gone. The roof was solid under me, but they had become, to my sight, as vaporous as ghosts. A phantom Hildegrin sprawled on my right. I thrust my hand into his chest and felt his heartbeat against it, like a moth that struggled to escape. Jolenta was dimmest of all, hardly present. More had been done to her than Merrin had guessed. I saw wires and bands of metal beneath her flesh, though even they were dim. I looked to myself then, at my legs and feet, and found I could see the claw burning like a blue flame through the leather of my boot. I grasped it, but there was no strength in my fingers. I could not take it forth. Dorcas lay as if in sleep. There was no foam flecking her lips, and she was more solid in appearance than Hildegrin. Merrin had collapsed into a black-clad doll, so thin and dim that slender Dorcas seemed robust beside her. Now that intelligence no longer animated that ivory mask, I saw that it was no more than parchment over bone. As I had suspected, the Cumaean was not a woman at all, yet neither was she one of the horrors I had beheld in the gardens of the House Absolute. Something sleekly reptilian coiled about the glowing rod. I looked for the head but found none, though each of the patternings on the reptile's back was a face, and the eyes of each face seemed lost in rapture. Dorcas woke while I looked from one to another.
"What has happened to us?" she said.
Hildegrin was stirring.
"I think we are seeing ourselves from a perspective longer than a single instance." Her mouth opened, but there was no cry.
Although the threatening clouds had brought no wind, dust was swirling through the streets below us.
I do not know how to describe it, except by saying that it seemed as if an uncountable host of minute insects, 1/100th the size of midges, had been concealed in the crevices of the rough pavement, and now were drawn by the moonlight to their nuptial flight. There was no sound, and no regularity in their motions. But after a time, the undifferentiated mass formed swarms that swept to and fro, growing always larger and more dense, and at last sank again to the broken stones. It seemed then that the insects no longer flew, but crawled over one another, each trying to reach the center of the swarm.
"They are alive," I said.
But Dorcas whispered,
"Look, they are dead."
She was correct. The swarms that had seethed with life a moment before now showed bleached ribs. The dust motes, linking themselves just as scholars piece together shards of ancient glass to recreate for us a colored window shattered thousands of years before, formed skulls that gleamed green in the moonlight. Beasts, Eluridons, lumbering spellii, and slinking shapes to which I could put no name, all fainter than we who watched from the rooftop, moved among the dead. One by one they rose, and the beasts vanished. Feebly at first, they began to rebuild their town. Stones were lifted again, and timbers molded of ashes were laid into sockets in the restored walls. The people, who had seemed hardly more than ambulant corpses when they rose, gathered strength from their work and became a bandy-legged race who walked like sailors and rolled cyclopean stones with the might of their wide shoulders. Then the town was complete, and we waited to see what would happen next. Drums broke the stillness of the night. By their tone, I knew that when they had last beat, a forest had stood about the town, for they reverberated as sounds only reverberate among the boles of great trees. A shaman with a shaven head paraded the street, naked and painted with pictographs in a script I had never seen, so expressive that the mere shapes of the words seemed to shout their meaning. Dancers followed him, 100 or more capering in lockstep, single file, the hands of each on the head of the dancer before him. Their faces were upturned, making me wonder, as I wonder still, if they did not dance in imitation of the 100-eyed serpent we called the Cumaean. Slowly, they coiled and twined up and down the street, around the shaman and back again, until at last they reached the entrance to the house from which we watched them. With a crash like thunder, the stone slab of the door fell. There was an odor, as of myrrh and roses. A man came forth to greet the dancers. If he had possessed 100 arms, or had worn his head beneath his hands, I could not have been more astonished. For his was a face I had known since childhood. The face of the funeral bronze in the mausoleum where I played as a boy. There were massive gold bracelets on his arms, bracelets set with jacinths and opals, carnelians and flashing emeralds. With measured strides, he advanced until he stood in the center of the procession, with the dancers swaying about him. Then he turned toward us and lifted his arms. He was looking at us, and I knew that he, alone of all the hundreds there, truly saw us. I had been so entranced by the spectacle below me that I had not noticed when Hildegrin left the roof. Now he darted, if so large a man can be said to dart, into the crowd and laid hold of Apu Punchau. What followed, I hardly know how to describe. In a way, it was like the little drama in the House of Yellow Wood in the Botanic Gardens. Yet it was far stranger, if only because I had known then that the woman and her brother and the savage were chant-caught. And now it seemed almost that it was Hildegrin, Dorcas, and I who were wrapped in magic. The dancers, I am sure, could not see Hildegrin, but they were somehow aware of him, and cried out against him, and slashed the air with stone-toothed cudgels. Apu Punchau, I felt certain, did see him, just as he had seen us on the rooftop, and as Isangoma had seen Adjia and me. Yet I do not believe he saw Hildegrin as I saw him. And it may be that what he saw seemed as strange to him as the Cumaean had to me. Hildegrin held him, but he could not subdue him. Apu Punchau struggled, but he could not break free. Hildegrin looked up to me and shouted for help. I do not know why I responded. Certainly, I no longer consciously desired to serve Vodalus and his purposes. Perhaps it was the lingering effect of the Alzabo, or only the memory of Hildegrin's rowing Dorcas and me across the Lake of Birds. I tried to push the bandy-legged men away, but one of their random blows caught the side of my head and knocked me to my knees. When I rose again, I seemed to have lost sight of Abu Punchau among the leaping, shrieking dancers. Instead, there were two Hildegrins. One who grappled with me, one who fought something invisible. Wildly, I threw off the first and tried to come to the aid of the second.
Severian!
Rain beating upon my upturned face awakened me. Big drops of cold rain that stung like hail. Thunder rolled across the pampas. For a moment I thought I had gone blind. Then a flash of lightning showed me wind-lashed grass and tumbled stones.
Severian!
It was Dorcas. I started to rise, and my hand touched cloth as well as mud. I seized it and pulled it free. A long, narrow strip of silk tipped with tassels.
Severian!
There was terror in the cry.
Here! I called. I'm down here!
Another flash showed me the building and Dorcas's frantic figure silhouetted on the roof. I circled the blind walls and found the steps. Our mounts were gone. On the roof, so were the witches. Dorcas alone bent over the body of Jolenta. By lightning I saw the dead face of the waitress, who had served Dr. Talos, Baldanders, and me in the cafe in Nessus. It had been washed clean of beauty. In the final reckoning, there is only love. Only that divinity. That we are capable only of being what we are remains our unforgivable sin. Here I pause again, having taken you, reader, from town to town. From the little mining village of Saltus, to the desolate stone town whose very name had long ago been lost among the whirling years. Saltus was for me the gateway to the world beyond the city imperishable. So too, the stone town was a gateway. A gateway to the mountains I had glimpsed through its ruined arches. For a long way thereafter, I was to journey among their gorges and fastnesses, their blind eyes and brooding faces. Here I pause. If you wish to walk no farther with me, reader, I do not blame you. It is no easy road.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive Producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambricks. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1981 by Gene Wolfe. Audio recording copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.